Christmas is here, and once again, a collection of ghost stories is available for a special Christmas treat. These three are taken from the 1904 collection, 25 Ghost Stories, and so I trust you enjoy them. Thank you to all my listeners, I trust you've enjoyed the variety of episodes over the last 12 months. And here's to 2023. Wherever you are, and whatever you do at this time of year, I hope you and your family have a wonderful time. Take care, and don't be afraid if you need the light on during this trio of terrifying tales. The Phantom Hag. The other evening in an old castle, the conversation turned upon apparitions, each one of the party telling a story. As the accounts grew more horrible, the young ladies drew closer together. "Have you ever had an adventure with a ghost?" said they to me. "Do you not know a story to make us shiver? Come, tell us something." "I'm quite willing to do so," I replied. "I will tell you of an incident that happened to myself. Towards the close of the autumn of 1858, I visited one of my friends, a sub-prefect of a little city in the centre of France. Albert was an old companion of my youth, and I had been present at his wedding. His charming wife was full of goodness and grace. My friend wished to show me his happy home, and to introduce me to his two pretty little daughters. I was feted and taken great care of. 3 days after my arrival, I knew the entire city, curiosities, old castles, ruins, and everything else. Every day around 4 o'clock, Albert would order the cab, and we would take a long ride returning home in the evening. On one such evening, my friend said to me, "Tomorrow, we will go further than usual. I want to take you to the Black Rocks. They are curious old druid stones on a wild and desolate plain. They will interest you. My wife has not seen them yet, so we will take her." The following day we drove out at the usual hour. Albert's wife sat by his side. I occupied the back seat alone. The weather was grey and sombre that afternoon, and the journey was not very pleasant. When we arrived at the Black Rocks, the sun was setting. We got out of the cab, and Albert took care of the horses. We walked some little distance through the fields before reaching the giant remains of the old druid religion. Albert's wife wished to climb the summit of the altar, and I assisted her. I can still see her graceful figure as she stood draped in a red shawl, her veil floating around her. "How beautiful it is! But does it not make you feel a little melancholy?" said she, extending her hand towards the dark horizon, which was lighted a little by the last rays of the sun. The afternoon wind blew violently, and sighed through the stunted trees that grew around the stone cromlechs. Not a dwelling nor a human being was in sight. We hastened to get down and silently retraced our steps to the carriage. "We must hurry," said Albert. "The sky is threatening, and we shall have scarcely time to reach home before night." We carefully wrapped the robes around his wife. She tied the veil around her face, and the horses started into a rapid trot. It was growing dark. The scenery around us was bare and desolate. Clumps of fir trees here and there and furze bushes formed the only vegetation. We began to feel the cold, for the wind blew with fury. The only sound we heard was the steady trot of the horses and the sharp, clear tinkle of their bells. Suddenly, I felt the heavy grasp of a hand upon my shoulder. I turned my head quickly. A horrible apparition presented itself before my eyes. In the empty place at my side sat a hideous woman. I tried to cry out. The phantom placed her fingers upon her lips to impose silence upon me. I could not utter a sound. The woman was clothed in white linen. Her head was cowled. Her face was overspread with a corpse-like pallor, and in the place of eyes were ghastly black cavities. I sat motionless, overcome by terror. The ghost suddenly stood up and leaned over the young wife. She encircled her with her arms and lowered her hideous head as if to kiss her forehead. "What a wind!" cried Madame Albert, turning precipitately towards me. My veil is torn. As she turned, I felt the same infernal pressure on my shoulder, and the place occupied by the phantom was now empty. I looked out to the right and left. The road was deserted. Not an object or person in sight. "What a dreadful gale," said Madame Albert. "Did you feel it?" I cannot explain the terror that seized me. My veil was torn by the wind as if by an invisible hand. I am trembling still. "Never mind," said Albert, smiling. "Wrap yourself up, my dear. We'll soon be warming ourselves by a good fire at home. I'm starving." A cold perspiration covered my forehead, and a shiver ran through me. My tongue clove to the roof of my mouth, and I could not articulate a sound. A sharp pain in my shoulder was the only sensible evidence that I was not the victim of a hallucination. Putting my hand upon my aching shoulder, I felt a rent in the cloak that was wrapped around me. I looked at it. 5 perfectly distinct holes, visible traces of the grip of the horrible phantom. I thought for a moment that I should die or that my reason should leave me. It was, I think, the most dreadful moment of my life. Finally, I became calmer. This nameless agony had lasted for some minutes. I do not think it is possible for a human being to suffer more than I did during that time. As soon as I had recovered my senses, I thought at first I would tell my friends that all that had passed. But I hesitated, and finally did not, fearing that my story would frighten Madame Albert, and feeling sure my friend would not believe me. The lights of the little city ahead revived me, and gradually the oppression of terror that overwhelmed me became lighter. As soon as we reached home, Madame Albert untied her veil. It was literally in shreds. I hoped to find my clothes whole and prove myself that it was all imagination. But no, the cloth was still torn in 5 places, just where the fingers had seized my shoulder. There was no mark, however, upon my flesh, only a dull pain. I returned to Paris the next day, where I endeavoured to forget this strange adventure, or at least when I thought of it, I would convince myself to believe it was a hallucination. The day after my return, I received a letter from my friend Albert. It was edged with black. I opened it with a vague fear. His letter informed me that his wife had died the day of my return. Our second tale. A misfit ghost. Every boy with a knowledge of adventurous literature, otherwise known as novels of action, knows of the phantom ship, the spooks of the high seas. But it has not been known that ships themselves are haunted, and that currently, in the service of the United States Coast Survey, there is such a vessel now in commission, that is by our own officers supposed to be haunted. Yet the Eager, a 100-foot schooner of the Coast Survey, is looked upon in the service as a very undesirable vessel to be aboard of. About her there is an atmosphere of gloom that service jest cannot dispel. Duty on board her has been shunned as would be a pestilence, and stories have been told by officers who have cruised aboard her that they are not good for timid people to hear. Officers have hesitated about telling these uncanny stories, but they have become sufficiently well known to make duty aboard the Eager unwelcome among the Coast Survey men. The Mohawk was launched on the 10th of June 1875 at Greenpoint, and she was by then the largest sailing yacht afloat. William T. Garner, her young millionaire owner, was very proud of his new craft, and all the then leaders of New York society were invited to participate in the good times afloat with which her launching was celebrated. Commodore Garner, then but 33 years old, and his young wife entertained charmingly, and the trim, speedy Mohawk was christened with unusual merry festivities. Soon after that, however, she was capsized by a sudden squall off the landing at Stapleton, New York, and 6 people were drowned like rats in her cabin and forecastle. Then the Mohawk was raised at a cost of $25,000 and purchased by the United States government for the service of the Coast Survey. Her name was changed to Eager, for Jack Tar is proverbially superstitious, and with the old name it would have been impossible to ship a crew. Lieutenant Higby King described his initial experience when he was assigned duty on the Eager in this way. "She had her full complement of officers minus 1 when I boarded her at Newport to complete the list. Every cabin was occupied but the port cabin by the companionway, and to that I was assigned. We had a jolly wardroom mess that night, and I retired from it early, as I was tired from my journey to join the vessel. The others who were still at the table regarded my retirement to the port cabin in absolute silence, having bidden me good night. The silence did not lead me to suspect anything, though I knew the Eagle had once been the Mohawk. My cabin door had the usual cabin lock of brass, and the porthole was also securely fastened. There could have been no one under the bed or sofa, as beneath each was a facing of solid oak panelling. I undressed lazily and left the light burning dimly in my bracket lamp. I tried conscientiously to go to sleep, for I don't know how long with my back turned to the light. The noise ceased in the wardroom after a time, and I knew the others had turned in, but I felt unaccountably nervous and restless. I turned over and over and faced the light, thoroughly wide awake. And there, in the single chair, sat an elderly man seemingly wrapped in deep thought. He was dressed in a blue yachting reefer and had a long grey beard. His hands were clasped in his lap, and his eyes were downcast. His face was not pale and ghastly, as the faces of ghosts are supposed to be, but ruddy and weather-beaten. I regarded him in scared silence for I don't know how long, though it seemed an hour when he, or it, or whatever it was, disappeared. During that time the ghost, and such I now believe it to have been, made not a motion, nor did it say anything. Presently I looked again, and it was gone. At breakfast, the others watched me critically as I took my seat. I had not intended to say anything about my experience, for I thought then that I had seen some sort of hallucination, and strongly suspected that I was verging on insanity. Lieutenant Irving asked me if I had slept well. I replied that I had. "Didn't you see anything?" he inquired. I then quite frankly admitted that I had, and described my experience. Then I learned that each one of the seven others present had tried the port cabin at one time or another, and each had seen the self-same apparition. It had acted in exactly the same way in each case. It had acted in exactly the same way in each case, except with Irving, who had shot at it with his pistol when it immediately disappeared. Some of the others had been led by their curiosity to inquire if anyone lost on the Mohawk resembled this figure, and found that none of the unfortunate ones at all fitted the description. For that, it had been dubbed by them the Misfit Ghost. That one experience was enough for me, and after that, by courtesy, shared the cabin of another fellow. Irvin and the others corroborated the story of Lieutenant King, and as an additional evidence that the Eager is haunted, Lieutenant Irving describes that a New Year's Eve experience of the Eager's officers, that is to say the least, was novel in the way of supernatural manifestations. It was at mess, the first toast. Sweethearts and wives had all been drunk, as it always is by Yankee sailors the world over on occasions of festivity. Everyone was feeling happy, or as Thackeray has it, pleasant, when suddenly the sliding door separating the wardroom from the companionway closed slowly with a loud squeaking noise. They had seldom been closed, and it took the entire strength of a man to start them from their rusty fastenings. Yet, upon this occasion, they started easily and closed tightly while the officers jumped to their feet in breathless astonishment. Half a dozen men hauled them open in haste, but not a soul was behind them or anywhere about. "It must be our old friend of the port cabin," suggested one. And in awe-stricken silence, we drank to the health of that misfit ghost. Our last tale is The Spectre Bride. The winter nights up at Sault Ste. Marie are as white and luminous as the Milky Way. The silence that rests upon the solitude appears to be as white as well. Nature has included sound in her arrestment. Save the still white frost, all things are obliterated. The stars are there, but they seem to belong to heaven and not to earth. They are at an immeasurable height, and so black is the night that the opaque ether rolls between them, and the observer in great liquid billows. In such a place, it is difficult to believe that the world is peopled to any great extent. One fancies that Cain has just killed Abel, and that there is need for the greatest economy in the matter of human life. The night Ralph Hagedorn started out for Echo Bay, he felt as if he was the only man in the world, so complete was the solitude through which he was passing. He was going over to attend the wedding of his best friend, and was in fact to act as the groomsman. Business had delayed him, and he was compelled to make this journey at night. But he hadn't gone far before he began to feel the exhilaration of the skater. His skates were keen, his legs fit for a longer journey than the one he had undertaken, and the tang of the frost was to him what a spur is to a spirited horse. He cut through the air as a sharp stone cleaves the water. He could feel the air as he cleft it. As he went on, he began to have fancies. It seemed to him that he was enormously tall, a great Viking of the Northland, hastening over icy fjords to his love. That indeed reminded him that he had a love, though indeed that thought was always present with him, as a background for other thoughts. To be sure, he had not told her she was his love, because he had only seen her a few times and the opportunity had yet to present itself. She also lived at Echo Bay, and was to be the maid of honour to his friend's bride. Which was another reason why he skated on almost as swiftly as the wind, and why now and then he let out a shout of exhilaration. The one drawback in this matter was that Marie Bourgeois's father had money, and that Marie lived in a fine house, and wore otter skin about her throat, and little satin-lined mink boots on her feet when she went sledding, and that the jacket in which she kept a bit of her dead mother's hair had a black pearl in it as big as a pea. These things made it difficult, nay impossible, for Ralph Hagedorn to say anything more than, "I love you." But that much he meant to have the satisfaction of saying, no matter what came of it. With this determination growing upon him, he swept along the ice which gleamed under the starlight. Indeed, Venus made a glowing path toward the west, and seemed to reassure him. He was sorry he could not skim down that avenue of light from the Love Star, but he was forced to turn his back upon it, and face towards the northeast. It came to him with shock that he was not alone. His eyelashes were a good deal frosted, and his eyeballs blurred with the cold, and at first he thought it an illusion, but he rubbed his eyes hard and at length made sure that not very far in front of him was a long white skater in fluttering garments who sped over the snows as fast as any werewolf ever went. He called aloud, but there was no answer. And then he gave chase, setting his teeth hard and putting a tension on his firm young muscles. But however fast he might go, the white skater went faster. After a time he became convinced, as he chanced to glance for a second at the North Star, that the white skater was leading him out of his direct path. For a moment he hesitated, wondering if he should not keep to the road, but the strange companion seemed to draw him on irresistibly, and so he followed. Of course it came to him more than once that this might be no earthly guide. Up in those latitudes men see strange things when the hoar frost is on the earth. Hagedorn's father, who lived up there by the lake and worked in the copper mines, had once welcomed a woman at his hut on a bitter night, who was gone by morning and had left wolf tracks in the snow. So yes, it was so, and John Fontenelle could tell you about it any day, if he were alive. Ah, the snow where the wolf tracks were is melted now. Well, Hagedorn followed the white skater all the night, and when the ice flushed red at dawn and the arrows of lovely light shot up into the cold heavens, she was gone, and Hagedorn was at his destination. Then, as he took off his skates while the sun climbed arrogantly up to his place above all other things, Hagedorn chanced to glance lakeward, and he saw there was a great wind rift in the ice, and that the waves showed blue as sapphires beneath the gleaming ice. Had he swept along his intended path, watching the stars to guide him, his glance ever turned upward, all his body at magnificent momentum, he would have skated to that cold grave. The white skater had been his guardian angel. Much impressed, he went up to his friend's house, expecting to find there some pleasant wedding furore. But someone met him quietly at the door, and his friend came downstairs to greet him with a solemn demeanour. "Is this your wedding face?" cried Hagedorn. "Why, really, if this is the way you are affected, the sooner I take the warning, the better." "There is no wedding," said his friend. "No wedding? Why, you're not... Marie died last night. Marie? She died last night. She had been skating in the afternoon and she came home chilled and wandering in her mind, as if the frost had gotten into it somehow. She got worse and worse and talked about you all the time.
Of me?
We wondered what it all meant. We didn't know you were lovers.
I didn't know it myself, more's the pity.
She said you were on the ice. She said you didn't know about the big breaking up thing, and she cried to us that the wind was offshore. Then she cried that you could only come in by the old French creek if you knew how to.
I came in that way, interrupted Hagadorn. How did you come to do that? It's out of your way.
So Hagadorn told him how it had all come to pass. And that day they watched beside the maiden, who had tapers at her head and feet, and over in the little church the bride who might have been at her wedding said prayers for her friend. Then they buried her in her bridesmaid's white, and Hagadorn was there before the altar with her, as he intended from the first. At midnight on the day of the burial, her friends were married in the gloom of the cold church, and they walked together through the snow to lay their bridal wreaths upon the grave. 3 nights later Hagadorn started back to his home. They wanted him to go by sunlight, but he had his way and went when Venus made her bright path on the ice. He had hoped for the companionship of the white skater, but he did not have it. His only companion on his journey home was the wind, and the only voice he heard was the baying of a wolf on the north shore. The world was as white as if it had just been created, and the sun had not yet coloured, nor man defiled it. Merry Christmas. Sleep well, and have a wonderful new year. Take care.